evening, everybody. You know, for years I thought that that chant was referring to the profound insight that my teacher had, and that we were proclaiming the profundity of the offering. But, and yeah, I suppose, but really what it's saying is the Dharma rarely encountered, we don't encounter something that is separate from ourselves. That's another way to see it. We encounter it every moment of our life, the Dharma, the phenomena of our life, our perceptions, our thoughts, our inclinations, our everything is Dharma. It's all the phenomena that make up our experience. So that's another way of looking at that. We rarely encounter it. Well, we maybe rarely realize every moment with wonder how odd it is. It's really kind of odd. Here we are. Who am I? Who are you? What is this? Of all in all of the galaxies, the vast galaxies that we know of, this is one of the configurations. And yet we all get very caught in just this is it, this is reality. So that's part of what that dedicatory chant is before a Dharma talk, is reminding us how profound this is. The very ordinary, which is all we have, is the ordinary. And yet, if we don't realize it, we can suffer. There's a quote, let me just find it here. Uchiyama Roshi, in his commentary on the Instructions to the Cook by Dogen, he says, the degree of separation from the reality of life appears as suffering and struggling. So the degree to which we have this impression that there's a me in here and life out there, that there's some kind of separateness to it all, makes up our suffering. How is it that if we sit in Zazen, and maybe some of you have had some moments during Zazen today of just the simplicity of just sitting, not a lot of mental machinations going on, but just being here. It's very easy. It's very direct. Nothing is added to it. Nothing is missing from it. It's just what it is. And we miss that. And we search for something very profound, and we think that Buddhism is going to offer us something extraordinary. And yes, in a way, these teachings are, because they are so natural, they're so inherent in the true situation, they are extraordinary. We don't have to believe anything. Every other religion, you believe something. But that's really hard, not to have something to believe. This is a very, very different basis for a practice. It's very different. Really difficult. So Qian Zhu, who was a ninth century wise person, said, the experience of studying Zen is like hiding your body in fire. Even if you have iron guts and a brass heart, here they will surely melt and flux. The experience of studying Zen is like hiding your body in fire. That's a really interesting statement. sometimes sitting is just agony. Has anybody felt that? So fire is one image that could be used of the profound suffering that we encounter when we look for a way to relieve us of our ordinary suffering. I think as Chogyam Trungpa calls it, neurotic suffering. But then Chanju says, even if you have iron guts and a brass heart, here they will surely melt and flux. So what he's saying is that this practice is going to get to everything that is causing suffering. Everything. So, you know, we could say, so what's, why is it so hard to sit? Why is it hard, so hard to sit with not a lot going on? Or nothing going on? Why is it so hard to not, to kind of not get swept into thinking and the usual body tensions? Do you notice tension when you're sitting in your body? If you haven't, I hope you notice it. Why is it so hard to just sit in a relaxed way and breathe and be present with nothing going on, nothing wrong, good companions? You know, it's really impressive how gripped such deep habits that we have of not only thinking but creating worlds that are so distressing to us, and bringing the distressing worlds that are real, I mean, there's a lot going on in this world that's pretty dire, bringing it into a moment of quiet, you know, rather than really being free to just release ourselves. So there's a certain kind of rigidity of mind, of habit energy. Habit energy, we talk about giving up attachment. Well, this is the nitty-gritty of that. It's not attached, you know, I love it, I want it always here. It's just our thoughts are so gripping. They're so hard to stop. Just for a rest. So really, Zazen, it's so helpful when you come to sit every day, hopefully, you're sitting every day, to say, this time, right now, is a time to rest the mind, to open the heart, to enjoy the simplicity of just simply being. You know, nothing to do, nothing to do. Sit on the dock of the bay, waste time, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when my mind is very busy, I bring that up. Sitting on the dock of the bay, just to remind myself, just chill, soften up. If we were lucky in our childhood, we had a lot of time like that. Not everybody was so lucky to be able to be that safe, to be able to be, just be. But that is what we do in our practice. And when we regularly visit that kind of relaxation and openness, it really shines such a bright light on when we're not, what's going on. So we really do get to know ourselves in ways that we don't necessarily get to if we approach it cognitively. This is a very, very powerful, a very original medicine for healing the heart. So, Zazen does not cure everything, but if we are going to be effective in bringing about a world that we want to live in, we need to begin with ourselves and want to live in our own bodies. in our own minds and our own hearts. So that is kind of the essence of Zazen practice, to be so present. It doesn't mean, it also doesn't mean getting into critical mind when thoughts come up or when you get caught, because we all get caught. I think most of my life in my Zazen, and I've been practicing many years, most of that time I've been caught up in, well, tonight, you know, I planned a way to arrange my garden. You would never know it looking at me. You know, I was like, for a little bit, but then I came back. So the mind does what it will do. Thoughts present themselves. It's not like we're summoning them. We have favorite thoughts, thoughts that are delightful, and thoughts that I think of as torture thoughts. I have torture thoughts. And I don't engage them so much anymore, but I did for a long time, until I recognized, oh, this is a torture thought. It is absolutely designed to drag me into my worst suffering places. Confusion and thinking on the cushion. Or, you know, if I was a little bored, it wasn't so entertaining to just be sitting here. So I was still in a mind of expectation. When I get bored, there's a mind of expectation. But if I was bored, I could just think about sex. That'd do it. That'd get really pulled into all kinds of places. So now, when that happens, I know, oh, wait a minute. It's kind of like when Buddha would say to Mara, Mara, now I know you. I know that these are some of the tricks. That mind that does not completely want to relax can pull up with a sure result of re-engaging. So when we're sitting, Zazen, first, you know, we always begin, and I mentioned it tonight, I always start, when the bell is rung, I listen to the bell to see how long that sound goes on, and actually it goes on a pretty long time, if it's well rung. that's the beginning, and then into the body. And just really, really feeling the, you know, either a body scan, beginning with the top of the head and going down bit by bit by bit, or beginning with the feet and coming up, or just the sensations through the senses. So what is being seen, what is being heard, what is being felt, what is being touched. And then settling there, and then there's one more part of my own routine, which is to then, once I'm really settled in that, I then look at, and Dogen says, turn the eye to look within. So looking within is one way to describe just looking at awareness itself. Not just the sensations, which are the object of awareness. That's what awareness is taking in. But then awareness itself. Which can come and go and come and go. That perception of awareness itself. And then, of course, in longer sitting, in retreat, I can set out to just really develop stability in awareness itself. Any of us can do that. But you know, the thing that's so amazing is we're always aware. We're always aware, but we may not notice it. You know? I mean, when you're really absorbed in thought, that's what you're aware of. You may not be at all aware of what's going on around you. It's really interesting, you know, to sit. One of the things that we were talking about at a meeting that I was just at was the practice of going and sitting outside on a bench and just sitting there for an hour or two. Just sitting. Not reading, not using your phone, not talking to anybody, but just sitting and being present. And one of the things that happens is people walk by and you can see what they're thinking about or how they feel about what they're thinking about. It was the first retreat I ever went on. It was on Vashon Island, and when I came back, I was downtown at First and Pine waiting for the bus, and I felt like I could read everybody's mind because I had never noticed how you look at people, you can just see what's going on. When you're quiet and not a lot's going on in your own, you can just see it. It's really interesting. And that's just one example of all the stuff you notice when you begin to quiet the mind regularly. There's so much to be seen and understood. The mind really clarifies. I mean, the cognitive mind really, it becomes clearer when we regularly sit. So when there's a situation in life that's really upsetting, it's especially valuable to sit before any decision about how to respond to it. And I'm talking about your personal life. But even, you know, politically, nobody knows really what to do. But it is way valuable to sit and calm the whole system. And very often you get some insight that is useful and penetrates all of the reactivity. Because so often, if you're like me, you know, just knee-jerk, just react. Let's see, is there anything else I wanted to say? So the teachings in Buddhism are the place in this tradition of meditation is what I've been talking about now. There are also lots of teachings, none of which you have to believe, but all of which is recommended to investigate, like the teaching of impermanence. That's something that you can just say, okay, today I am going to observe impermanence. And it's amazing how it is observable practically every single moment in every situation. Impermanence is apparent. Impermanence is. As well as interdependent arising. There are orders of magnitude that you can look into that with. But the one that one of my favorites is it's just noticing, you know, you wake up in the morning and you think you know what the plan is and what the day is going to be like, and then immediately it starts to veer in its own way because the conditions are not what I was aware of, and so they all influence the direction of things. They're constantly interacting in ways that are, some of them are apparent and obvious, and many of them are not. So we get surprises during the day. The value of deeply realizing and integrating that awareness has to do with not digging into one view and thinking, you know what's going to happen, because we never know what's going to happen. And I think that's especially significant right now in the very difficult various situations we're all collectively being swept into. in the world, climate and political, social stuff, if we know, we really don't know what's going to happen. It sure looks like we probably can predict the way things are going. But if we hold out that don't know mind, that possibility that we don't actually know, then we can continue to come from a place of wisdom, connecting, speaking the truth, and being open to noticing things that we might not have noticed that makes a difference in the way we respond. Because there's so much of what's difficult in the world now is the pitch of reactivity is dangerously high. And so working with our own and knowing that there are many who are doing the work that we're doing is encouraging us. It encourages me to continue to just say, okay, what I can do is be present and not come from a fear energy or reactivity energy or habit energy, but respond in a way that I can say, yes, so this is the right way for me to have responded here. So how about we open up to any questions or comments on any of this?
I have just a question.
Yeah.
What's the difference between impermanence and change?
Is there a difference?
When you said that, I was just thinking the only constants is change. Are they the same, or is there a difference?
What do other people think about that? I would say change is. The only constant is change. Is that helpful?
Well, that's just how I saw it, and I thought maybe I'm missing something. Maybe there's a subtle difference. Okay.
No, although, you know, what is the pace of change? The only constant is change, except maybe your own habit patterns. It took me years to quit smoking. But it is accomplished. But that's just the pace, you know.
There's a saying I calligraphed a long time ago. I can't remember it all now, but I think it's from the Dhammapada. And it starts out, birth will end in death. And then, I can't remember, but all things are transient and permanent. If that helps, all things are transient and permanent, which is sort of change and impermanence. So it's saying they're kind of the same.
That sounds like a journey, the way you're describing it.
A journey? Birth will end in death?
Yeah, it's a journey.
Well, all things in cyclic existence. That's how it goes. Mm-hmm. All things in cyclic existence are transient and impermanent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Process. Continual. And we've been reading the Diamond Sutra, which the commentary by Musang, he refers at some length to quantum physics and the discovery in that field that if you continue ad infinitum to spot something that seems solid, if you look closely enough, it is energetic. It's continually processing. There's a continual exchange. So, yeah.
So I think of this as very comforting because it means if you're having a bad time, it's permanent. So if you're having a hard time in meditation, you never know when something clicks and then suddenly joy. I've had this happen so many times. And like suddenly you're so joyful you just don't want to even get up from the cushion. And you can be in the middle of the most annoying, you know, thought patterns that you can't get rid of and then turns on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
And my whole life is like that. You never know. Very comforting.
Yeah. unless you know, a dream come true is unfolding and it's going to change.
Yeah, that's the other side.
That's the other part of the suffering of change.
Yeah.
Is not having what you want or losing what you have. That's hard won. Yeah.
Could you say a little more about turning the gaze inward that you talked about? Experiencing awareness, but without the object of awareness. Am I getting right what you said?
Yeah, it's it's called pure awareness. Well, the word pure makes me a little nervous, but awareness itself.
So. Sometimes I feel like, okay, I'm having an experience that feels like I'm just, it's not a thought thing, but it's an awareness that has an object of awareness. I'm aware of something, some sensations in my body, or anyway, it's a little unclear to me how what that would feel like, or what that experience would be like, to have awareness without an object, without knowing. It seems like you see what I'm saying?
I do. It's hard to say it, isn't it? It's hard to, because what we talk about with direct experience is not, words do not get it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, because it is not words. Well, the experience of awareness without an object, don't dig in too closely to that. I like the awareness itself, because awareness itself is there's no viewer, which maybe is why it's called pure. But when you're aware of sensation, there's a self that's aware. So there's still the separation, but awareness itself is just. It's a thoroughgoing appreciation directly of no separation, because there's no you, and there's no other, there's no object, there's no subject as separate from object. Is that totally not helpful? Or?
Don't know yet.
But the thing is, the thing that's wonderful is in Zen we have this thing called koan, which means something that really is puzzling, that is enticing, that feels like there's something there, and the only way to get to it is just to keep until you kind of break through and you go, oh, okay, oh. One of the traps in Buddhism, and the language of Buddhism, is it's very highfalutin. It can be very grand, and so we can stop looking at our ordinary experience. But all of this awakening, what we're awakening to, is the thorough freedom and openness of our direct experience, as opposed to being chained to the way to a view. That view is very, very open. There are always, I was reading something years ago and I thought, well, does that mean that there's never a time when we are without view? And I found that really worrying. Oh no.
That's what I'm thinking right now, because you were saying it's such a reactionary time and there are things that are happening that's not right. That is not right, and it's hard to to feel that in settling into settle the self upon the self, sort of, to follow the breath, that the right answer is going to come to stop it all, or to change it, to make positive change.
Mm-hmm. You're attached to making positive change. Yeah, you believe
so.
In positive change.
Yeah.
Well, in Buddhism we cover our bets because we say the first noble truth is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
The first truth of conscious living, conscious being, is difficulties and problems. Things are not as we would design them to be according to our ideas. Yeah. But to get back to this, is there a place of no view? I originally was really worried that there would be a place of no view, and I've missed it, and I can't get to it. But then I realized, actually, there's never a place of no view. We cannot get that. We're always in some perspective in relation to the whole, but there are larger views and smaller views, and we can expand our field. Who knows how large? And so when we get to something is not right here, and I've got to change it, the change cannot come from that particular bundle, because it's a self-reinforcing system. You know, systems theory is really important to study, because if we try to change in the terms of the system, we're not going to free ourselves. Because systems are self-reinforcing. So therefore, to be able to relax and open, and also realize that even though I think I'm the center of the universe, so do you. You know, we all experience being the center of the universe, and in one way, we are the center of the universe, each of us. You know, we're creating it. But in another way, we're just one little energetic nodule.
I'll share that the question you brought up about why is it so difficult to sit, I think that was a question, that was probably the first question that really drew me into all this. I just couldn't figure that out. My first, like, however many months, 3-4 months of sitting regularly were total agony, just physically. Really, really, really uncomfortable. And I just couldn't figure out why is that the case. It's totally puzzling. So anyway, I appreciate hearing the question.
What happened?
It got easier. Another thing I remember was encountering people who would come, because I was coming on Tuesday nights to write up discussion, and you know, I would encounter people who would come who would say, you know, that share some experience about how, you know, one of the first times I sat down, I just felt this huge relief, right? And I remember thinking, that is not what's going on for me. over time, I mean, I've come to have days that way.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not every day is that way, and there are still times when it's difficult, but it stopped being the baseline that sitting was painful. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long it took.
Yeah. And yet you kept at it, which is interesting. What was motivating you?
Probably lots of things. But I think that question is really puzzling. Why is this so hard?
Mm-hmm.
It's so simple.
Yeah.
You know, it shouldn't be.
It's a good one to ponder. If it is really difficult, why is this so difficult? You know, and each of us would come up with different realizations about that. Yeah. But, you know, a generalization could be resistance to what is, whatever form it's taking, you know, physical pain or psychic or...
One of your opening sentences had to do with, can you sit with your body in the middle of a fire?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. That one caught my imagination as I thought of all the ways that that could come about. And just as Trevor was saying, you know, he was sitting in the middle of a fire.
Mm-hmm.
He was sitting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great image because there are a lot of different kinds of fires that we experience. May we never experience the physical, the actual physical sitting in the midst of fire. But we never know. So thank you. I think we'll bring it to a close now, and I appreciate you all listening, and I hope that there's something in all of this that encourages you and supports your practice.